Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. And this time we're coming to you direct from Cannes Film Festival. Today's going to be a little bit different to the usual run of things because we've managed to get up out of the country and head over to the south of France to enjoy a whole load of movies that are screening as part of the 2023 Cannes Film Festival. And so I've assembled a set of cinephile Avengers to come together and tell us all about some favorites. What we're going to do is a little bit of a kind of round robin speak where we're going to go round. We're going to each pick two favorites that we've seen at the festival, or at least two films of notable interest that are worthy of discussion. To give you some context, we're recording this on the second Tuesday of the festival, which is a whole week into it, so we've seen a fair amount at this point. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. We had a late night last night. We had a lovely meal together. And then we came home and did some work. And then we're up and we're going to record this and probably head out and go and see some more movies today. So the sun is shining, I believe.
We can't tell. It's a shuttered room.
It's a shuttered room. So, yeah, we can't tell what the weather is like.
I shouldn't have taped all that cardboard over the windows. That's on me.
Okay. And any background noise you may hear. It could be our lovely flatmate Markesh, who is getting ready for his day out.
Mr. Seafood Plateau.
Indeed. So I'm going to go completely arbitrary by this list I've made, and it seems like a good one to start with. So Charles, do you want to kick things off and talk about your first choice?
Yes, absolutely. We should open with an opener. The first film I'd like to discuss was the opening selection for the director's Fortnite sidebar selection. You walk on down the beach to their theater, and I went to go see a French courtroom drama called The Goldman Case, which this is actually rooted in historical fact, that in the 70s, this sort of far-left activist, rather cantankerous man named Goldman, was arrested for having robbed, done two robberies, and then also two murders. And he copped to the robberies, but contested having committed the murders. And so this is the substance of his trial. He, a deeply irate man, is brought before a court to answer for himself. And he essentially, you know, as we like to say in the States, I'm putting the system on trial. This is one of those sort of courts movies in which he not only refutes the charges levied against him, but he sort of takes issue with the whole construct of the French judicial system to begin with, which he finds based on very bourgeois and flawed cultural assumptions about the trustworthiness of the police, about the objectivity of the judge. And so he, in many respects, almost refuses to engage with the process, you know, to the great protest of the lawyers who are just trying to help him. And he makes a very impassioned political argument for his own innocence. He asserts the racism of French police. It's a real firecracker of a movie.
And is there any order in that court, Charles?
Well, so this is my favorite thing, and I was told by a French person that this is perhaps more cinematic and not necessarily how it works. But there just appear to be no rules in French court whatsoever. I watch a lot of Law and Order, obviously. And, you know, the way these court scenes go is if someone says something outrageous, you get to object. You say, I object, harassing the witness, or, you know, any number of objections. And in French court, that just doesn't happen. People yell things and no one does anything. And it seems like the most punitive thing the judge can do is not to hold someone in contempt of court and throw them into a cell, but just to be like, you there. Stop doing that. And so, yeah, it makes for very lively, very tense courtroom scenes with lots of fussing and fighting.
There's hullabaloo.
There is a great
There's
deal.
There's such a hullabaloo.
Hullabaloo, rigmarole, falderal, et al.
So give us a bit of context as to where this film played in the festival, and do you think that people will get to see it soon?
My hope is yes. I do believe... Has it been acquired? I guess I'm not sure. But yes, so the way Cannes works is that they have the big marquee titles in the competition section, and then the sort of second tier official selection is called Un Certain Regard. And this sidebar program, which is called the Director's Fortnight, the Quinzaine des Cinéastes now, it used to be Royalisateurs, but that's a gender term, and they thought, why bother? And so, yeah, it's an interesting collection of films this year. A lot of them are first films, but I guess the idea is it's just things a bit off the beaten path that are not, you know, so big name that they make it to the big dance of competition. In 2019, they showed Robert Eggers' The Lighthouse there, which I suppose, you know, indie American director, it sort of fits within that purview. And so, yes, this film, you know, while it is not a huge production, I think it has been well reviewed enough that we should expect to see it in theaters soon enough. People seem to like it, and courtroom dramas, they sell because people know what to expect and the pleasures are pretty consistent.
Sophie.
Yes.
I see from our little hastily byroad list here in front of me that you are going to be taking on a biggie as your first choice.
Yes.
Maybe give a bit of context as to the film first and then dive in.
Sure. Okay, well, I'll also just give a bit of context for why a Jonathan Glazer film is something that I anticipate so much. You know, the last we saw from him was Under the Skin, which was more or less 10 years ago. And I have loved every single one of his films. That makes it sound like they're more of them than they are.
You've done all four of them.
Yes. Well, three thus far. So even without knowing anything about the subject, I was like, a Jonathan Glazer film is playing in Cannes. This is instantly my most anticipated film at the festival. And I kind of knew the log line more or less. And I knew that it was based on a Martin Amis book, R.I.P. But that he did with Under the Skin, he very much interpreted it and made it his own. Like, this is stuff I knew going in. Just it was like very, very loose adaptation. Not that I've even read the Martin Amis book. So, yeah, absolutely nothing could have prepared me.
It's barely departed Martin Amis.
Yeah, I did swiftly say R.I.P., but maybe I should have made more of that. But I also like to give a bit of context of, like, you know, much like Pauline Kael, just a little bit of personal context, because I think it kind of brings things to life a little bit. Like, I saw this with you, David, and I think you and I, when we walked out, we were both just, like, staring into the middle distance, walking in silence. And then you said, I think this is the most disturbing film I've ever seen. And then I said, yes, I agree. And I, at some point, shed two single tears. But while I was watching it, I was just watching it. And then it ends. And the way that it ends, it's not even 100% clear that it's ended. It could just be a coda, because the technique, the interplay of sound and a totally blank screen, we've seen it before in the film. So it's based on the historical fact that next to Auschwitz lived Rudolf Hoss and his family. And this is a very forensically told tale and shot in a very eerie way that I think you can actually feel. Jonathan Glazer has said he didn't want to shoot this, like, looking at the Hoss family, being like, oh, you know, maybe a bit more light, you know, like kind of fussing over aesthetic details. He had a totally empty set and just hired these drone cameras and had cameras set up. Actually, I don't know if they're drone cameras, but there were cameras on set that were just filming the family as they went about their day. So there is this quite eerie alien feeling, but the what we're watching is not, you know, historical villains rubbing their fingers and chuckling. It's the most sort of, you could say, mundane, minutely observed details of just running a household, and that makes it all the more haunting when you sort of hear little details dropped in, or like you see that the dress that Mrs. Hoss is choosing Hedwig, is choosing it must have come from the camps. Like, there'll be all these little references that to this family are just a stop of life that they do not blink twice over, that is just the most awful stop imaginable. And there's also the sounds. Occasionally you will hear screams. And the other thing is, there's this scene where Rudolf Hoff explains in detail the layout of the chambers and how they work, and he doesn't reference what's happening in any detail. I think he talks about units or something, and you know what he's talking about, but no one in that scene blinks an eye. But he explained, well, one thing that he explains is how frequently there will need to be fires burning, and then every now and then you'll see like a puff of smoke from the chimney and you'll know what that symbolizes. So it's the most understated and forensic depiction of horror. And the thing that I found very moving about the film in the end is that it's saying that the stuff that went on the other side of the wall is too sacred to show. And there are ways that I have not articulated, and I won't articulate, that he also represents the horror of what's happening, that are very, very conceptual and very, very, like, visceral. Because there's a combination here of different modes of storytelling. There's this focus on this family that's quite forensic and detailed, and, you know, the banality of evil incarnate. But then there are these moments where it totally switches gear, and I could just feel things in my body happening, and I didn't even know what they were, but it was like a true immersive experience. And the way these elements of it come together, I think in the end, is like really, really hard to fully grasp and articulate, but it feels just very profound. And also, like, he's created original cinematic language and told a story that I think a lot of filmmakers or even storytellers in any medium will be like, okay, this is it, it's time for me to tackle the Holocaust. But this doesn't feel like him ticking a box. This feels like him really, really grappling deeply with something that has been weighing on him. And like, the other thing I think to say is that it's been kind of 10 years in the making, and a lot of the stuff comes from research. All the phone calls that we see Hoss having, the layout of the camps, it is from historical record. And the way that this all came to be is that he was reading The Zone of Interest by Martin Amis. To My Name is Everyone, Gone But Not Forgotten. And Martin Amis' book, The Zone of Interest, is like a fictionalized version of Hoss, but Glazer started researching the real Hoss and found it more interesting. So yeah, it's like tons and tons and tons of research, and what we watch in the film is the tip of the iceberg married to the most extraordinary level of thought and craft. And it just leaves you feeling ways that you don't understand, but then like hours later, like a scene will come before your eyes and you'll be like nailed to the back of your chair.
Wow. Yeah, absolutely. And it's also got this, the surreal aspect of this situation is also used in a way with these little kind of ambient inserts as well, that there is stuff that he sort of drops in there that kind of experimental almost, that you're sort of left to ponder.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah, I all the way through it, there was stuff I was trying to figure out, but I was also totally pulled along by it because it's such assured and precise filmmaking, even though it's operating at a level that's quite conceptual.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member, who receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans.
Hannah, would you like to give us your choice?
Yeah, I have chosen May December, which is a new film from Todd Haynes, which is one of my most anticipated of the festival. I love Todd, speaking like he's a close personal friend. I think he would be fine with that. And I was very excited when this was announced because it is a film with Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore, who, again, two actresses I love. And I thought that the kind of log line was very intriguing, which the premise for this is that Natalie Portman is playing an actress who rocks up at Julianne Moore's house with the intention of kind of shadowing her because she's going to play her in a movie. And the thing about Julianne Moore's character in this film is that she was involved in a highly publicized scandal some 20 years earlier, where she had an affair with a 13-year-old boy and went to prison. And now, 20 years later, they're still married, they have 3 children, and yeah, it's a very kind of knotty melodrama that 5 minutes in has this incredible crash zoom moment, which really sets the tone, I think, for the film, where you're just kind of disarmed by how funny the script is and how they bring all this kind of levity to what is actually a kind of very troubling and dark subject. But at the same time, it's not like Haynes and Sammy Birch, who wrote the script, are kind of trivializing it. There's a lot of kind of weight to the characters and the actions. And, you know, the more time we spend with them, the more we kind of get to know these characters, particularly Julianne Moore and Charles Melton, who plays Joe, who is her husband. And yeah, I was just really kind of impressed at how easily the film blends this kind of very dark humour and deeply sad character content. There's some scenes in it where you're just kind of, your heart is just breaking for this poor guy who spent his whole life thinking that he's in this like deeply romantic relationship, and then starts to process kind of what happened to him when he was a teenager. And yeah, I just think it's such an elegant film that I'm still days later like chuckling to myself thinking of some of the line readings and some of the scripts. And this is a first time script as well from Sammy Birch, who I believe was a casting director in a previous life. And to come out with such a, like, an assured and intelligent script and kind of your first go is just like mind-blowing to me. Such an impressive film.
And would you say it's typical of Todd Haynes?
I think it's definitely funnier than his films, more explicitly funny. I think he does make funny films, but this is definitely more of a kind of comedy than he would typically make. But the melodrama, I think, is also kind of a new direction for him. You can definitely kind of see like the DNA in something like
Far From Heaven.
Yeah, it's a little Far From Heaven. There's kind of, I think, hints of like Velvet Goldmine and even a little bit of Carol in there, I think, as well. But it's definitely more kind of like, I feel like he's bringing in kind of like soap opera references, a little bit of kind of Real Housewives. And my kind of first instant reaction was a bit of Pedro Almodóvar in the kind of like very highly strung characters expressing their emotions. but yeah, I mean, just the whole thing is just such a delight. Like, there's incredible costume design as well, and these kind of like nap dresses that Julianne Moore's character is wearing. And she's really like cosplaying as this, who, me? I would never harm a fly type housewife. And clearly just having such a great time playing this character. I don't think I've seen a film here where the actors seem to be enjoying themselves as much as they were in this film. And there's just so many wonderful little details. Like, you spend more time with the Portman character and realize, like, oh, she's actually like meant to be a bad actress. Like, this is, you know, she's not playing like an A-lister, she's playing a TV actress who's trying to be taken seriously. And yeah, there's just so many kind of little moments and little asides. There's a wonderful scene which I won't spoil because this will be coming out, I'm pretty certain, everywhere, but definitely in the UK it's already got distribution. There's a wonderful scene on the roof involving the character Joe and his 18-year-old son, and they have a quote, air quote, bonding moment together. But yeah, I just think it's such a kind of knotty, intriguing film, and yeah, really delightful. I'm kind of hoping that one's the Palm, because I think it would be the most fun choice.
Amazing. Right, we're gonna go on next to, and I'm gonna talk a little bit about the film with the, I don't think, great title of About Dry Grasses.
Wasn't there some sort of conversation about whether or not that might have been mistranslated?
Yeah, I mean, in the film, the character refers to just one type of grass, you know.
Audiences are going to be very disappointed if they're expecting multiple grasses.
The grass community will demand a refund.
The grass heads.
Well, this would be, this is the new film from the Turkish auteur, very serious man, Nuri Bilge Ceylan, and he won the Palme d'Or in, I think it's 2014, for Winter Sleep. He had another film in 2018 called The Wild Pear Tree, and both these films were 3-hour plus meditations on kind of male misanthropes and very, very sort of dialogue driven. He's very, very openly talked about his influences, which were Chekhov and Dostoevsky, and he's spoken about how he was being more inspired by literature than he was by film when it came to making these films. And you can kind of tell that, you know, these films had like phone book sized scripts to them, and he seems to have filmed the whole things. And About Dry Grasses is kind of like, I would say, like, it plays like the final part of a trilogy, maybe. There may be more, who knows. But it's another film about a male misanthrope, this time a teacher in a small Anatolian village. Initially, he I guess, sort of has a feel, this feeling of intellectual superiority, but at the same time, there is a sense that he is a good teacher and is trying to sort of impart his wisdom onto his children. There is an incident where one of his favourite students makes a complaint about him for this very small trifling matter, which apparently meant a lot to the girl, but he didn't realise how much. And he is instantly put into the crosshairs, and the local school board bureaucracy are drawing him in for meetings and asking him questions, and there is a kind of guilty till proven innocent vibe to the whole thing, and of people not wanting to ruffle feathers or get into trouble, and he feels very hard done by this. And this is all within about the first hour of a 3.5 hour film, and you kind of think that it's going to be this thing on cancel culture and like people being kind of put in this place for, you know, and chided for these reasons that they maybe don't understand. But then it kind of goes off in a very different direction, and it turns into a kind of almost a sort of romantic psychodrama where him and his roommate both fall for the same woman. And the centerpiece of this film is this probably about 45 minute long dialogue sequence over a dinner table that covers all matters existential in a very, very kind of poetic and beautiful written way. And yeah, it's just, on paper, it seems like not the most fun movie you're ever going to see, but it is something that is completely immersive and compelling, and you're just swept up by the richness of the dialogue and the characters, and it just, it's this really, he just sort of whisks up this really convincing microcosm that feel like, although that the characters are articulating very, very complex ideas and emotions, he's written it in a way that makes them like hit the viewer. And yeah, it was, I'm a fan of his, and I love this one.
One thing I'm curious about, I have not yet had the chance to see the film. And you talk about, you know, his literary influences and the script. What sort of visual vocabulary is he working
with? Is
that
one?
Well, he's filming on quite sort of abrasive digital, mm-hmm. And it switches between very sort of wide vistas of this landscape. It's snowing the whole. It's set during winter, and it's very deep snow that like pretty much the entire film. And then these very cozy, candlelit interiors, very low light. It's unfussy, I would say. I don't think he's like the visuals, the dialogue is, you know, capturing the people talking and getting the best out of the dialogue is probably his key concern here.
Snow is a good link to the film that Charles is next slated to discuss. That's
indeed
a snowy film.
It is indeed.
Well, let's get on to your second film then, yeah. Charles.
I was interested in comparing and contrasting two courtroom films that I have seen and quite enjoyed, the second being Justine Triet's competition title, Anatomy of a Fall, which I think it is much more loyal to the Law and Order model than the Goldman case, which is really all right there in the courtroom. Whereas this is, I think, much more of a character piece. It is also about someone who makes it difficult to sympathize with them. I think the audience is sort of placed in the role of the jury and made to look at this person and consider the things that we find dislikable about them. It stars Sandra Hüller, who is also the star of Zone of Interest that Dear SMK spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
She is a novelist who is doing an interview one afternoon. Her son is off playing elsewhere in the house, and all of a sudden, her husband's body falls from the uppermost floor of their home and hits a small shed next to their home, and he, by the time he hits the ground, has perished. And so Sandra Hüller, who is, you know, overwrought with grief, is nevertheless brought into court because, you know, Occam's razor would suggest that when a spouse dies, it is always the other spouse who has done it. And so with the help of a friend of hers, a lawyer, she tries to prove her own innocence while refusing to sugarcoat the nature of her relationship with her husband, which was often very contentious. He was a frustrated writer who resented her success. And in court, all of these brutal details about the interiors of their relationship start to bubble to the surface and cast her in a rather guilty-looking light. And she makes the very salient, very correct point that no matter, you know, regardless of whether or not they were at each other's throats, regardless of whether or not they detested each other, it is about what is demonstrably provable. And even, you know, it's not illegal to argue with your spouse. And she maintains that She maintains her innocence, even as she reveals just how deeply dysfunctional their relationship was. And we also see the effect that this has on her very young son, who's a tremendous young actor, whose name I should have looked up before I began speaking. But he gives a really terrific performance. There's a scene late in the movie where everything just comes pouring out of this kid. It's really something to see.
Also, please pay some verbal respect to Snoop the dog.
Snoop the dog, an essential part of this film, really one of the top dogs at the festival.
He goes through it in this movie as well. That dog's suffering.
He goes through a lot. He has a medical crisis that is resolved with a merciful swiftness, and he ultimately becomes sort of he helps crack the case, doesn't he?
He does.
Lassie, stand aside.
Yeah, sorry, Lassie. Lassie found dead in the ditch.
So I saw that film yesterday, and I also saw another film later called Club Zero by Jessica Hausner, which we're not covering on this pod, but we'll be able to read our review online. But both films contain scenes of dogs eating vomit.
Dogs, they love it. It's like caviar to them. They can't get enough.
It's something I've learned.
It's unpredictably flavorful. You never know what you're getting from it.
Horrible pleasure.
Well, thank you for that, Charles. Sophie, next up, you have a more comic selection, I would say.
I needed to pick something that was different to the zone of interest in scope and timbre, but to link with what we've just been chatting, has a great dog in as well. So this is a film by the beloved Finn Aki Kaurismäki, who won a lot of hearts and mind with The Other Side of Hope, his compassionate take on the refugee crisis. And as I understand it, the man goes around making compassionate takes that are also incredibly funny in a deadpan and cinematic fashion. And this slots right in, and it's also, he has a very neat narrative container, which is that these two people, they find each other and then it's near impossible to connect. Like, he gives, it's very, very funny. So these two characters, just to set them up a little bit. So she, when we meet her, is like working in a supermarket. And he, when we meet him, is, oh God, he goes through so many jobs. So I guess he is, what's he, James? What's his first job?
Well, I was actually trying to work out myself. He's like a metal worker, I think.
It's a skilled job, but he's also an alcoholic. And whatever time of the day it is, the moment the boss is ahead his turn, he'll be supping from his hip flask, which doesn't really work that well for him. But these two, they have a run-in. They meet each other, but don't talk, a karaoke night. And his mate is performing. His mate is very funny as well and earns the epithet, the karaoke king. And they see each other, and then they see each other again, and they have a date to the cinema. And that's important because this is like a very, very cine literate in an affectionate way film. Like, there's a film that they go to see together, and just there's a punchline around it in terms of like a single serving character coming out and comparing it to I'm not going to name the names of the films, but it's just there are lots of these wonderful little details in there. Anyway, so she gives him her number, he like instantly loses it, and it's just like lots of things get in the way like this, but they, I don't know, there's just the kind of fatedness to them. But even when things that get in the way are like pretty fundamental, but each scene is just an absolute joy to watch. Like, the comic beats and the character beats come together, and it's just a delight.
I love all the kind of the signs and things. I love the way that the hospital looks like a pub as well. You know, when they go to a hospital in the end, and she walks through this kind of wooden door, and it's like, this looks like just another one of the bars that they're going into.
Is there a bar in the hospital?
Probably.
People would like going to hospitals a lot more if they had a bar.
But no, I concur. This is a delightful film. I mean, I would say just a quick kind of coda, because Hannah mentioned before that she'd like to see Todd Haynes win the Palm. I mean, I would love for this film to win the Palm, actually. I mean, I think there are other films, probably individual films, more deserving, maybe Zone of Interest, but like as a kind of culmination of this kind of huge career where he's been kind of.
Why do you hate Todd Haynes, David?
Oh, I think Todd's great as well. I think the reason for Todd, though, I think there's I think he could, he's definitely gonna win something.
I would be happy for that to win screenplay. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, I would love that to happen for Aki.
He's a charming, charming fellow.
Yeah. One other thing about this film that I find quite interesting is I interviewed him for his previous film, The Other Side of Hope, and it was 10 o'clock in the morning, and he was like visibly drunk.
Nice.
And
I have a lot of respect for
that. And
I feel that this film could, you know, might even be a sort of slightly confessional side to it of the character who is kind of like tormented by his alcoholic demons and having to kind of, he's sort of realizing that alcohol is kind of drag, you know, his sort of drinking is dragging him down in all these various ways.
This tees up just an example of how incredibly dense and yet poetic the dialogue is. So this guy who's drinking goes to her house for a date and she sees him go to the hallway and have a swig, and the kind of camera goes to her face and she's just staring. And she says, like, I like you, but I won't date a drunk. And he says, and I won't take orders. And summarily, robotically takes his coat and leaves. And these are how all the scenes play out, just the most kind of economical dialogue. And yet they match each other in that respect. So it's almost like a song that they're singing together.
Totally, totally, totally. And I know Charles is going to run off after this podcast and see it. So hopefully
I'm quite excited. You've both sold me on it amply.
Okay, you're going to hate it now.
No, I think you'll like it.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So Hannah, your second one is another one from the director's fortnight.
Yeah, and kind of a romance of a sort. I have chosen Joanna Arno's The Feeling That the Time for Doing Something Has Passed, which the title has been giving a lot of grief to friends and colleagues of mine, and that no one can remember how to say it.
I simply cannot.
Apart from me. But yeah, so this is a first feature. But she, Joanna's had quite a meteoric rise in short filmmaking, I believe. And she had a auto-fiction documentary called I Hate Myself, which has been highly recommended to me. And yeah, this film is about a young woman in her 30s called Anne, who works a very kind of we never really understand fully what she does. It's kind of a low-level corporate job that is made purposefully confusing to the audience. And she lives in New York and has this kind of long-standing BDSM relationship with this guy, Alan, who kind of has no real respect for her as a person, and she's shown to kind of have quite low self-esteem and be quite resigned to this stagnation, I guess, of her life. And so we have this kind of like setup of different chapters where she's meeting these different men and kind of pursuing different types of relationships, whether that's BDSM or kind of just dating. And the thing that I really enjoyed is just how funny this film is. It's very deadpan and it has this very stilted style of like dialogue, which I thought was quite novel and somehow still very true to the way people talk to each other, despite its kind of stylized elements. And anyways, so late in the film, maybe halfway through, she meets this really sweet guy called Chris, played by Babak Tafti. And he is kind of just this breath of fresh air who is just so lovely to her. And I think she's kind of almost disarmed by this, doesn't really know what to do with it. But he thinks she's great. And it's just so, I found a really kind of nuanced take on a community that is often kind of maligned or like treated quite poorly in fiction, which is the BDSM community. And you can really tell that Joanna has like put a lot of herself into this. I mean, physically, she is the lead actress, but also she wrote, directed, and I believe edited this film. So she's a real multi-hyphenate. And yeah, I just think it's such a breath of fresh air and exactly what Director's Fortnight is for, really, in terms of discovery. And Charles is sitting looking at me like, and,
say the thing.
And. So Charles and his lovely fiance Maddie are in this film. You can catch them in a kind of brief sequence at a party,
a star-making appearance. I think
it's a wonderful head turn that Charles does. We've all You're spoken,
a real head turner.
We've all spoken at great what length about this.
I haven't seen this film, but what was the state of Charles's hair in because it's gone through its various lengths?
This was post the big haircut, not my metalhead phase.
Okay.
I had respectable human hair.
Okay.
And there was an elegance to you, Charles.
Thank you.
I haven't seen this film, but the way you describe it, I mean, maybe I'm completely off course here, but it sounds a little bit kind of Lena Dunham, but sort of pushing that world a bit further.
Yeah, and not quite as self-absorbed, I don't think, as Lena Dunham. I think it's just very kind of low-key, and there's a lot of very funny stuff with her parents, who I believe that her dad is playing her dad. I'm not sure about if it's her mum playing her mum, but she goes on this holiday with them to a cabin, and they spend the whole time kind of arguing about spending time together, despite the fact they are spending time together. And she's trying to read her book, and her dad's just sitting there, like, singing this, like, union protest song while she's trying to read her book. And it's just, yeah, I think it captures the kind of passive aggressive element of parent-child relationships very well. And yeah, I think she's just such an unselfconscious screen presence. But yeah, the character I would describe as very self-conscious. It's weird. Like, she puts, you know, I think that she has put so much of herself out there with this film, and I can't wait to kind of see her talk about it and see about kind of how her own life has inspired it. Because I know from like her past work, she's very kind of like into the autofiction thing, but you don't want to kind of presume to know.
Well, in the Q&A that we witnessed, she did say that she had taken a lot of scenes verbatim or pushed slightly from her life.
Yeah, so yeah, I think it's exactly the kind of like thing that Director's Fortnight is for, in terms of like discovery and championing these new voices coming through. And yeah, I really, really liked it. I really enjoyed it.
And Charles is available for future projects. Please contact me,
Sophie,
at The
White Lies. Oh, you're my representation.
No, I'm your representation.
Oh, so, this is news to me.
Yeah, so breaking news, I'm Charles's agent.
Okay.
You may go through The Two White Lies to contact me regarding Charles's future opportunities.
I'll work for scale.
Next up, another biggie I'm going to talk about for a little bit. It's a film called Asteroid City by the filmmaker Wes Anderson. I think we'll try and maybe tiptoe around some of the elements of it, because I think what my experience of seeing it was one of surprise as much as it was joy, I think. To note that the trailer that many people will have already seen, in which depicts this world of mid-20th century sort of southwestern state desert location, in which this group of characters kind of meet together across a few days to attend a junior stargazer festival, which involves the awarding of prizes to a
junior stargazer convention.
Junior stargazer convention, indeed.
We must be precise as Wes is precise.
Indeed. And then they are there for a kind of prize giving for a series of inventions they have produced. And there is also a eclipse type event that people are gathered for to view, in a kind of similar way to Grand Budapest Hotel, which is framed as a novel about someone recounting their early life. This too has a kind of similar framing device that gives this sort of central story like a very different feel to it. It's very much a story in quote marks. And what he wants to do with this film is he wants you to enjoy it on this superficial level, in that it's fun and it's emotional, and he's whipping up this narrative and these characters and these situations that I found, you know, very engaging and funny, and you know, there is the kind of melancholy and tragicomic element to it all as well. But then he's sort of ratcheting things up even further by having this other layer that kind of muddies all the kind of the moral and emotional elements of the film. And actually kind of, I think, enhances them in a way, because it's sort of, he's pinpointing a very kind of human element to how this and all his films play out. I think in many ways the film comes across as maybe a little kind of rejoinder to anyone who maybe sees his films and finds them maybe too distant or detached or mannered. Just on a kind of scene for scene level, it feels like the film that where the formula he has kind of tweaked his formula to like this place of complete immaculate perfection. Wow. Where there's just, it's just, it's a dazzling thing to watch. It just it's sort of like wind blowing in your face.
I'm seeing the film this evening, and I'm curious, this is a very technically involved film, yeah?
I would say, yeah. On a structural level,
he built this whole little town out in Spain.
Yeah, he built the whole little town out in Spain. But then you have this, as I said, this other framing layer as well. And yeah, it's maybe a little bit lower key than in terms of like different sets and different places, and than the French Dispatch or Isle of Dogs. But I think it's like conceptually maybe a bigger film. Wow. I mean, you. Sophie, Hannah, you guys both seen it as well. Do you have any comments you'd like to pass?
I will say that I think there's been a lot of kind of memes about the scale of the cast in this one, because I think it is one of his, like, he always has big casts, but I think a lot of people are like, who isn't in Asteroid City? It's a very big name cast. We've got Tom Hanks making his first appearance in a Wes Anderson film, and I think Steve Carell and Margot Robbie are also kind of newcomers to the company. But then we have, you know, people like Jason Schwartzman, who kind of plays certainly the biggest role in the film, who has been with Wes since perhaps the beginning. And I think it's maybe one of the best examples of everyone in the Wes movie kind of playing their part to the kind of pitched at like just the right level. You know, there's no wasted kind of movement in this film. Everyone is, you know, they come and they do their little bit and you're like, oh, that was absolutely delightful. That was just the right little, you know, little sprinkling of this person in the film. I don't want to say too much because like we're going to do so much more on this, I imagine, because it's a Wes film. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. Jake Ryan, who I was a big fan of in eighth grade, and I believe actually was in Moonrise Kingdom as well, even though he's like 20, so crazy to me to imagine doing that two Wes films by the time he's 20. But he plays Jason Schwartzman's son, Woodrow, who is one of the junior stargazers, and he's very funny and kind of seems to just like implicitly understand like the tone and cadence of how you should act in a Wes Anderson movie. And yeah, it's very fun, as I think all of Wes films are, but also just very touching, and shows this kind of real like reverence for like the craft of cinema as well, and the craft of storytelling. And yeah, I just think it's a very beautiful film with some incredible little like details, which I read the press notes for this film and was like kind of like reading bits out to anyone that would listen, because I find it so fascinating to learn how he made this world.
In a way, even though they're very different types of film, I feel like he and Jonathan Glazer are similar in the sense that every single little aspect of it has been thought of and conceived and fine-tuned, and that pays off in a deeply felt world experience. And I think this is his most emotionally naked film on several counts, not least the fact that Jason Schwartzman is in grief, but also in the fact of he is as interested in storytellers as the stories themselves, and he is a storyteller. And in a way, I feel like he's telling us about himself. That's not like an Easter egg. That's just there. That's just text. So I also think it's a rejoinder to anyone who just is like, oh no, Wes Anderson films, they're all like contrived. And no, like these contrivances are the way he's open with us. I think it's very emotional for all the kind of delightful details and jokes and deadpan humor and playfulness. Yeah, that's just part of Wes Anderson being open. So I think it's very, very emotionally
engaging film. And also shout out to Steve Carell. Every moment he was on screen was the best moment of my life.
There's also just one detail in this film that like blew my mind, is that there's like a martini, like automated martini machine, like where they put, you know, you put in money and it makes
a martini vending machine.
Sorry, that's what I was looking for.
The impossible dream.
What a concept. I was just like, this is incredible. We need to get on this. We need our top people on this straight away.
This is pertinent, I guess, more to the talk of a half hour ago, but I've just received some rather distressing breaking news. Netflix has purchased May December.
Well, not for the UK.
I suppose not, yeah.
Sky Cinema coming for the UK.
This is an American issue.
I mean, I don't know. At least it'll get a good awards campaign.
Yeah.
As many people will watch it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You know.
The people to whom it will smuggle in additional layers, it will smuggle in additional layers. The people to whom will simply watch it and boost its numbers, well, hey, that will happen.
You're all taking this much better than I am.
Why are you upset, Charles?
It won't be seen in theatres by people. It won't be available in the future to be played in theatres. They're very stingy with repertory rights. I don't trust the big red N.
No.
I hadn't thought about it in that respect.
Well, hopefully it'll get a Criterion in that weird, like...
And they're dealing.
Criterion, Netflix deal. They do, yeah.
Okay, let's round things off. We've kind of talked about this a bit so far, actually, but let's just put it, set it in stone. The awards that will be happening after this, you'll be hearing this podcast, but from what we've seen so far, it doesn't necessarily have to be the Palm, but is there maybe like one award that you'd maybe like to see happen?
I think Sandra Hüller for Best Actress, Anatomy of a Fall. I think that's a three-course meal and she's dishing it right up.
Yes, that's a good one. There's something about the Zone of Interest that makes it feel to me irrelevant whether it gets awards or not, because this is one for history. But yeah, so I'm actually with you, Jane. So I would really like Aki Kaurismäki to get, if not Best Director, then the Palm.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that. Trying to think of other things that from the competition that because it's actually been like one thing to note, it's just been a very strong competition this year.
Actually, this is a more interesting thing for me to say, because this is a great film that I've not mentioned, but I have reviewed for IndieWire if anyone wants to read more about it. Banal and Adama. It's a Senegalese film set in a small Senegalese village where two young people's love is being blamed for the droughts, and it's gorgeously shot. It's beautiful, but it's also stranger than it might initially seem. And you saw this as well, David. Yeah. So I'd like maybe best director there. I wouldn't mind that either.
I wouldn't be surprised if she gets like at the very least a kind of jury prize or, you know, something like that to sort of acknowledge up and coming talent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's her first film, and it's very bold and inviting.
Yeah, we've got a good review of that by Caitlin Quinlan on the website as well. Loads more coverage on the website. I will say, other than May December, I would like to see Messi, the dog from Anatomy of a Fall, who plays Snoop, get the Palm Dog.
That's spoken like someone who hasn't seen Fallen Leaves.
Well, if the dog isn't eating vomit, then like...
Well, okay.
Let the dogs eat vomit if they want to.
The dog goes on a poignant journey.
I can't believe there's been that many films here where dogs eat vomit. We were talking about this earlier.
It's the big theme of 2023.
There's only been two films.
That's too many.
I do agree. There's a nice dog in the Animal Kingdom.
Yes.
He doesn't eat vomit. That's a nice thing about him.
In the film, The Animal Kingdom, not the scientific classification.
I'm not going to answer that.
I'm asking you.
Do you want to know?
Okay. I've not seen this film.
It's a great film.
Okay.
Well, on that note, I think it's time for us to round up and to say that we're going to be back to normal business next week. But yeah, do go onto lwlies.com to check out all our coverage. Next week, we return to normal with animated superhero sequel Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse alongside Tina Satter's film of an unassuming NSA whistleblower, Reality. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe to wherever you get your podcasts. This Truth and Movies canned special was hosted by me, David Jenkins, and my guests this week were Hannah Strong, Sophie Monks-Kaufman and Charles Bromesco. The podcast is produced by TTO London and edited by Bob Skankers.
Mom. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.